But oh, I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. That's the legendary singer, pianist, songwriter, and civil rights activist Nina Simone. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Joining me to help us understand the life, work, and legacy of Nina Simone is Craig Werner, UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of African American Studies, and the author of numerous books, including A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America, Higher Ground, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Curtis Mayfield, and the Rise and Fall of American Soul, and We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Glad to be here.
I've been listening to Nina Simone now for a few weeks, getting ready for this conversation with you, and boy, she's such a powerful figure in so many ways. What interests you most about Nina Simone?
There's a lot. She's got a depth and a presence that's not much like anybody else. When you try to put her in any kind of a box, you could call her a jazz singer, you could call her a blues singer, you could call her a pop singer. She was trained as a classical pianist, and what she did was create a body of work that was absolutely individual and gets into the deepest levels of why music, why art matters.
It doesn't seem as if she's as widely known as some other figures, whether it's Mahalia Jackson or Aretha Franklin or some of the other figures that you've worked on. More of a smaller audience, even though she was such an icon. Why do you think that is?
It was because she was not part of the pop music world, although she had some hits. She had hits early and very late in her career. But she never played the game in a way that was designed to follow up on it. And her involvement with the civil rights movement meant that she had a profound connection with the people during that period of time. She had something, I guess you'd call it a cult following, that the people who love Nina Simone really, really love Nina Simone. But she's not as user-friendly as many of the other stars.
Tell us about what is interesting about her early life, what sort of formed her into the person she became, because she wasn't born even with the name Nina Simone.
No. She was born as Eunice Wayman in the small town, mountain town of Tryon, North Carolina, in the 1930s. She grew up poor. The family had to scuffle to make a living, but Tryon was not the Deep South. It wasn't the worst of the segregated world. The black and white children played some with each other fairly comfortably, a little bit longer. Her mother was a preacher, and she dedicated herself to her spiritual calling. And Nina Simone said many times during her life that she never felt the deep connection with her mother, and that's part of what formed, I think, her character. Her father was a whole lot more laid back, friendlier, closer to her. He liked pop music, his popular music of the time, the blues and whatnot. Her mother was suspicious and resistant about the popular music of the time. She sang church music, gospel music, and hymns. But Nina Simone grew up with a lot of music around her. She fell in love with playing the piano when she was 3 years old, by all accounts. And early on, she was really recognized as something of a prodigy.
I've seen video recordings of Nina Simone playing piano, and she was amazingly gifted as a pianist. If the family was poor, how did she get the kind of training that she needed to become so gifted on the piano?
Yeah, many black artists grew up learning in the church, and she certainly picked up some of that and learning from the popular music. But early on, her talent drew the attention of a white woman, a patron in Tryon, who decided that she was something really, really special and hooked her up with classical piano lessons from very early in her life. She studied with a British immigrant named Muriel Mazanovich, who was very demanding, very supportive, but absolutely did not allow Nina any leeway to make mistakes. Nina said that one of the things that she said to her was, Bach would do it like this way. Do it again, over and over and over until she got it like Bach would do it.
It actually sounds like my piano teacher, who was from Germany and would say, ach, if I made a mistake, and didn't want me to learn anything past more modern than Bach for a long time just to get the technical notes down there. So how do you see, if you listen to Nina Simone's music, how do you see that background of classical training?
Yeah, the demandingness is there. I mean, she said Bach is technically perfect. He is a mathematician. When you play Bach, every note is executed flawlessly. It has to be. So, interestingly, when she first started recording, one of the things she would do, even when she was recording popular songs, was play them classical and play, and as you say, you watch film of Nina Simone playing the piano, and it's more like Glenn Gould than Art Tatum, the jazz great. But one of her first hit records, really her first breakthrough in a lot of ways, was on her album Little Girl Blue. And the title song of that album, which we'll listen to now, demonstrates the way she went at it.
Sit there, count the raindrops falling on you. It's time you knew all you can ever count on.
As we're listening to that, you hear the tune that we're familiar with for Good King Wenceslas, the Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
You hear Bach, and then it turns into something more bluesy.
Yeah, and she actually makes it into a fugue. I mean, that's Bach the mathematician right there. The rules of the fugue are just so. But then she blurs it and blends it into Little Girl Blue. And her path to doing that was not a direct one. After she graduated from high school, it was clear that she had a future in music. And her patron, who had put together a fund for her, the people in Tryon, North Carolina, supported her. They knew she was special. Although, curiously, on her first recital, her parents were denied seats up front because they were Black. It was her white patrons there. Nina would not play until her parents were properly seated.
That's the beginning of that civil rights activist that would come into being.
And it's also the beginning of the demanding Nina Simone, which is another part of the story. But she attended a summer program at the Juilliard School of Music in New York. And the arc she was on was to go to a first-rate classical conservatory. Juilliard was probably just not going to take her at the time as an African-American woman. She could be in the summer program, but not in the regular program. And so she applied to the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, also one of the best conservatories of the time. She was turned down, and the reasons for it have never been clear. Certainly the fact that she was a African-American, certainly the fact that she was a woman, certainly the fact that she was dark-skinned had something to do with that. But she had moved to Philadelphia, and she took summer work playing piano in a nightclub in Atlantic City. And in Atlantic City, she took that job so she could continue paying for classical lessons, by the way. She got to the club that had hired her and started to play, and the manager said, you got to sing here, too. You're not just background music. You're not just an instrumentalist. If you don't sing, you don't have a job. So she started singing, but she mixed in her amazing piano playing and built up a following there, largely among students from New York who were working summer jobs in Atlantic City.
So she was singing nightclub popular or jazz music, but bringing in her classical background.
Yeah, to sing it.
And doing so to make money to support what she thought was a career
was
as a classical musician.
Exactly, exactly.
And why did she change her name at that point?
Well, she changed her name when she got the job in Atlantic City because she didn't want her mother to know that she was singing secular songs. Her mother would not have liked that. And apparently she came up with the name just on the spur of the moment. They needed something for the ad. And she said Nina was Spanish for girl. Sometimes she says a childhood nickname, though nobody else remembered that. And said Simone just because it sounded good. Sometimes she says for the French actress Simone Signoret. But yeah, so she declared herself Nina Simone and stayed with it. And when she was playing in the nightclub, she developed her performance style very early on. She demanded attention. She didn't want people drinking and talking and drowning her out. And if people were doing too much of that, she wouldn't play. But she described what she was looking for this way. She says, it's a spell that you cast. You start with a certain song, and you build the mood with another song that's related to the first song. And the third song is related to the second song, and so forth and so on, until you reach a certain climax and feeling. And by that time, you've got them hypnotized. I always knew that they're with me when I hear nothing but silence. Then you've got them. And I think that's a good time to listen to a little bit of one of her biggest hits, her song, I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Better stop the things you do. I ain't lying. No, I ain't lying.
It's interesting with that song, I Put a Spell on You, that she chose that as the title for her autobiography as well.
Yeah. And it's one of the songs people thought about with her, but she was so mesmerizing that people, she did have people under her spell.
I'm surprised the management would let her have the rule that people had to not buy drinks and stop talking while she played, but they must have understood
she had such
that she
following.
Had a following.
She had the following. People were coming, and they were buying the drinks, and then they were sitting and listening. And it became clear if you wanted just to be at a bar, go somewhere else. There are plenty of options there.
And what would you say was her first big hit?
Well, her first big hit was from the album Little Girl Blue. And it's a Gershwin song, I Loves You, Porgy.
From Porgy and Bess?
From Porgy and Bess, yeah. And it was a big hit. It hit the top 20 on the pop charts, number 2 on the rhythm and blues, the black charts of the time.
If she took from Porgy and Bess, then she was sort of playing with a sort of stereotyped role. What did Nina Simone do with that to make it feel right for her, to make it her own?
Yeah, what she did was she just absolutely refused the dialect part of the folk opera that it came from. She enunciated very, very clearly. And the most interesting piece of it is, for even though the song's called I Loves You, Porgy, and that's how it was on the album, she says, I love you, Porgy. She wasn't going to play a black role for anybody.
Let's listen to a little bit of Nina Simone, I Love You, Porgy.
Porgy, don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever.
That's Nina Simone's hit song, I Loves You, Porgy. More on Nina Simone when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Don't let him handle me with his hot hand. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer.
That's from Nina Simone's song, Mississippi, showing the civil rights side of Nina Simone. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner, and we are talking about singer, songwriter, pianist, and civil rights activist Nina Simone. Tell us about that song.
Yeah. Nina Simone wrote that song in response to the Birmingham church bombing in the summer of 1963, when four young girls, teenagers, were killed by white supremacist terrorists by bombing in the basement of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham at the culmination of one of the most important campaigns of the civil rights movement. She sings in the song, you know, Alabama's got me so upset, Tennessee. She wants to put it in the context of the broader issue. It wasn't just a one issue. It wasn't one event that caused it. And that the belly of the beast for white supremacy was Mississippi. And so she just knew she could say that and get the gut level response she wanted from particularly her African-American listeners.
Was the murder of Medgar Evers part of what she was?
It was all part
of the different things that was happening.
But it was the Birmingham event that really changed her. She had not been writing much in the way of topical songs before then, but she said, when they killed those children is when I said, I have to start using my talent to help black people. When they killed those little girls in Alabama, that's when I changed.
And was she under pressure from others, from leaders in the civil rights movement or other artists who were more political? Was she being pressured to become more involved?
Really not, because her presence was so clearly black. She was a figure of dignity. Everything she sang sounded like it spoke to the complexities and the depths of the black experience. Andrew Young, who was one of Martin Luther King's most important lieutenants in the movement at the time, said, every home I went to had Nina Simone. I mean everyone. For all of the people in the civil rights movement, it was an identity. You know what I mean? Her music was just sort of what you heard. There were two things that people in the movement would fight over. One was if you took their books. The other was if you took their Nina Simone albums.
Well, also the way she carried herself and dressed and looked, she proudly sported an afro before others were and African attire and carried herself regally.
She did, and the regal bearing was a big piece of it. And she had friendships with other artists who were, again, similarly deeply connected with the black community. Lorraine Hansberry was one of the first people who really challenged her. The playwright who wrote Raisin in the Sun, she said, why don't you get out there and do something more direct? Although she already loved Nina Simone's music. And the great poet Langston Hughes was a fan of hers, and they worked together, and Nina Simone recorded this song, which is based off of Hughes' poem, Backlash Blues.
Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash. I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues.
It's amazing how she takes the lyrics right out of the Langston Hughes poem and then makes it such an effective song.
Yeah.
And there's so much packed in there with the landlords and the Vietnam War and everything.
Yeah, you name it. It's the front pages, the back pages of every black newspaper in the United States. Right there. And she was present from that point on at many of the major events of the civil rights movement.
I wanted to ask you about her voice quality, because I've been trying to come up with an adjective. You know, when you're listening to most of the songs, not all of them, but most of them, there's a kind of strident or harsh or shrill sound, but it's beautiful. So none of those adjectives seem right to me. But it isn't that soothing, round tone that a Joni Mitchell would have. It is you hear it and it's piercing. And I don't even know what kind of adjectives to use, but it's different.
She demands attention with it. She does not, it's like when she's in the club in Atlantic City, she demands that you listen to her. I think it's very thick. I think it's dense. That you can think about beautiful singing as hitting the notes and getting the melody just right and getting the harmonies just right. For Nina, it's more like every note, every undertone and every overtone of the note is there at the same time. So if you think it's a simple emotion in the middle of it, you don't get to stay there, that there's something resonating. I feel it in my chest when I listen to her. And several people, including Nina Simone, said that her voice started to change after Mississippi, that her voice went deeper. It went harder. It's not pretty, but it's beautiful.
But you would never sing it as a lullaby.
You would never sing it as a lullaby. No, you definitely, definitely would not sing it as a lullaby.
I saw her referred to as the High Priestess of Soul.
Yeah, and it was on the High Priestess of Soul album. That was the title of one of her albums. And the cover image of that was very, very famous. She's in it's an Egyptian look. It's an African look. It's very brightly colored. The colors work with her dark skin tone beautifully. And it was the first of the albums by a major singer on which a female singer was wearing the afro, the natural hairstyle. And reflecting on that, Nina Simone said, it reflected Black pride. And that's when I changed it. I identified a lot with Africa and learned what they did and started wearing my hair in an afro. And she'd been present throughout the civil rights movement. The Black Power movement, as they called it, was sparked in Mississippi in the mid-60s. And the culminating moments where Black Power started to emerge, the march after the Selma in the Selma campaign to Montgomery, Alabama, after Bloody Tuesday, where they just beat up the marchers on the bridge. Significantly, Nina Simone's song Sinner Man was used as one of the major soundtracks in the movie Selma. But she's in Selma alongside actor Sidney Poitier, James Baldwin, Bill Cosby, Leonard Bernstein, the conductor, Tony Bennett, Mahalia Jackson, Joan Baez, and Andrew Young commenting on it says, Nina Simone stole the show, and it was because her music so reflected the soul and the feeling of the people there. And when the civil rights movement starts moving towards Black Power, she's moving with it. She develops a close friendship with Stokely Carmichael, activist who's generally thought of as one of the founders of the Black Power movement, and he called her the singer of the Black Power movement.
Did she respond to some of the ideas of the Black nationalists and to, for example, Muslim ideas that were coming in at that time? And I don't sense in her songs a lot of references to religion. I mean, obviously, her mother had been religious, Methodist. Where did Nina stand with all that?
She was loosely a Christian, but religion never played a central part in her art. She expressed her admiration for Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And after Malcolm X's assassination, his widow moved to the same suburb that Nina Simone was living in, Mount Vernon, New York at the time, lived just two blocks away, and their children became very, very close friends. So she was a part of it. But she was not really ideological. I mean, Angela Davis said that it was Nina Simone's voice that bestowed on the gathering, talking about the birthday party for Black Panther leader Huey Newton, an aura of historical transcendence. She didn't need to talk about the politics.
It just
she embodied
her,
them.
Through
Vernon,
her music.
Yeah. Vernon Jordan, another civil rights leader, once asked her why she wasn't doing more for civil rights. And she just looked at him and she said, using an expletive to start out the statement, I am civil rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, very.
And you hear the power in her music. You just don't sense that she can be put in a particular box. You know, we were talking about the quality of her voice and the strength and kind of piercing quality. one song that she did that has a totally different sound, it's much softer, is the song she wrote when she learned about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Can you talk about that one?
It's Why the King of Love is Dead. And at a performance just a couple of days after King's assassination, she started singing a kind of a Broadway standard, Sunday in Savannah, and then started almost preaching. She started meditating on Dr. King. She started talking about his assassination and singing just this beautiful song. The original version of it lasts like 15 minutes. It was boiled down for the records, called Why the King of Love is Dead. And you just feel the ache in her heart. And, you know, at times Nina Simone felt like she should be doing something more active there. But again, Andrew Young talked about that. She said, one of the things she said to me was that she really felt bad that she was not more active in marching and protesting and things like that. And I thought, how very strange and odd for her to say that. One of my friends who was there commented later, God, she was so present. She was everywhere in all our projects, in all our work.
More on Nina Simone when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
We must begin to tell our young.
There's a world waiting for you.
Yours is the quest that's just begun. When you feel in real love, yeah, there's a great truth that you should know.
That's from To Be Young, Gifted, and Black by Nina Simone. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner, and we are talking about music and civil rights icon Nina Simone. That title of the song, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, that became Lorraine Hansberry's title of her autobiography, right?
And Aretha Franklin recorded a fantastic hit version of it. Donny Hathaway. So it became an anthem. It became an absolute anthem.
And when Nina wrote the lyrics for that and recorded it, was she wanting to empower young girls in particular or just in general?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was at that moment when the emphasis in the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, was very much youth-oriented at the time. And she was channeling something. James Baldwin said something wonderful about her. She gave you back your experience, and you recognized it for the first time and made it possible for you to bear it. And I think that's such a beautiful way to think about the inspiration she was passing on. And you still hear that. You hear that in Black Lives Matter. Yeah, it goes deep.
In terms of acknowledging the pain, but somehow giving you the strength to endure it?
Exactly, exactly. And
that's the blues.
That's the blues, yeah, the laughing to keep from crying. Yeah, and Nina Simone didn't sing a lot of straight blues pieces, but she was deeply in that, taking the pain of the experience. And I don't think you hear that anywhere better than in her song For Women, which is a piece of art that transcends anything you can fit into 5 minutes on a record.
And before we hear part of that, how did she feel about her role as a woman, separate from her role as a Black at this time, this critical time in terms of civil rights? She was a woman in an industry dominated by men. She was a woman in a civil rights movement dominated by men. Would you say that she was a feminist? How did she feel about her own personal life as a woman?
Well, feminism means taking control of your experience and living your life in terms of your own vision of freedom. Yeah, she was a feminist. I don't recall her using the word. I haven't seen it. Certainly didn't emphasize it. She had a very, very difficult personal life as a woman, and she was aware of that. Her marriages, her relationships did not work out well, to say the least. She always wanted that kind of connection. She always felt like she had missed the boat on the last one. Her sexuality was ambiguous. She had very, very close, probably physical relationships with women friends, but certainly never defined herself or was seen as lesbian. Certainly, her role as a woman in the industry played a big role, but she felt underappreciated. She felt mistreated by the industry. She felt like she'd been financially ripped off, and she didn't take any guff. And so she developed a reputation for being difficult and demanding and angry and every stereotype that goes with being a strong woman.
Well, and artists are known to
yeah,
be
exactly.
pretty difficult. And she was also a mother.
She was a mother. And she, her daughter Lisa, who later went on to have a very successful musical theater career with roles in the original Rent and in The Lion King and Les Miserables, Lisa spent more time with Malcolm's widow and her children than she did with Nina. Nina was traveling a whole lot. Lisa always wanted Nina's approval. She only got it sometimes, and it was never easy. They had a sundering and then a reconciliation towards the end of the life. But Nina Simone certainly understood that being a woman was a major part of how her experience had been shaped, from being turned down at Curtis. It was certainly a part of that, just on down the line.
In the song Four Women, where there are these four different portraits or yeah. you know, scenes about different women, all of them seem to speak to the fact that for a black woman, it's a double whammy.
Yeah, at very least a double. And color plays into it. And it was a controversial song in the African American community because it addressed the reality of color prejudice, that skin color, that the texture of one's hair mattered. But she goes back deep into the history of slavery in it. She deals with the stereotypes of black women. It's a major piece of art. It stands alongside Zora Neale Hurston and Toni Morrison as the strongest expressions of black women's experience, and it rubbed the raw edges of it, of sexuality, and there's just a pure embodied rage that you can hear in it. Nina Simone said, "When any black woman hears that song, she either starts crying or she wants to go out and kill somebody. Because all I did was I just took them and said, all right, there's the problem. Every black in the world who heard that song knew what it meant. It's personal to 32 million blacks out there." And I don't think you hear that anywhere more starkly than at the end of the final portrait of a woman named Peaches.
I'm awfully bitter these days because my parents were slaves. What do they call?
That is an incredible ending, the power, and I guess it's the rage and power you hear mixed together.
Yeah, you just want to get out of the way. Whatever energy is being channeled there is so powerful, it could just explode you. It can blow you away. And that was part of the, I mean, it's easy to talk about the last phase of Nina Simone's life as being tragic.
How so?
She continued to perform. She could be a very popular performer, a lucrative performer. She could also walk out on shows midway in it. She had trouble with producers who didn't trust that she'd show up. She got to really just hating the United States in the 1970s. She went into a self-determined exile. She spent time in Africa. She spent time in Switzerland, in England, in France. She never found a place to settle herself. She drank. She used drugs. She used LSD during the 1960s, and they actually had a hit with I Got Life, Ain't Got No from the musical Hair at the time. But she never found a settling place. She never found the people she trusted around her. She had some collaborators, musicians that she worked with. But she was, I think it's fair to say, was a tormented person. And you could hear it in her voice. And you could hear it in her voice. We have a lot of live recordings of her from later on. Not a whole lot of studio stuff, but some live recordings. And the power is still there.
What would she have said about herself if she had to say, you know, who are, if someone asked, you know, what are you most proud of in your life, or, you know, who are you? How did she define herself in those years where she was feeling in a state of self-imposed exile?
Yeah. Well, I think she always understood herself as an artistic genius. She didn't make any, didn't deny it. She didn't back off on that, an underappreciated genius. She knew she was a great singer, and she knew she had an amazing eye to recognize a great song. They're the ones that she was known for, the hits, the civil rights songs. But when you listen to some of the later albums, she's always finding unexpected songs to cover. She's one of the great interpreters of Bob Dylan. She did versions of Just Like a Woman, Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, I Shall Be Released, which is just aching to listen to. She loved the Bee Gees, covering their song To Love Somebody and I Can't See Nobody. She covered Beatles songs. Her version of Here Comes the Sun is
gorgeous. I've heard that one.
Gorgeous. Yeah. Covered songs by Prince and Bob Marley. I mean, she was always out there as a musical seeker. And I think she always understood that the core of her genius was in the music.
She also seems to have stayed, I suppose her mother would have approved in a way, she stayed true to the classical roots of her training as well, because even when she's covering some other singer or in later works, you hear the piano, you hear kind of echoes of Bach, you hear all kinds of things.
All kinds of things. And in concert, she could just, I'm not going to say drift off because it was directed, but you could be listening to something and then you'd hear Chopin, you'd hear Liszt. I mean, it was amazing just what she could do. The her ear had been formed by classical music, and she never left it behind. She heard the potential musical richness and depth and the depth of the experience in everything. You know, I think of something that Maya Angelou said about her. She said, she is loved or feared, adored or disliked, but few who have met her music or glimpsed her soul react with moderation. She is an extremely, extremely realized artist.
You respond definitely not with moderation. Yeah. She's like, especially if I think of that ending of Four Women or some of the other things, very extreme sense of who she was and what she wanted to do with her music. Is there a song that you think kind of sums up her life and legacy?
I think that when I think of Nina Simone, I think about one of the things she wrote about herself. She said, I've had a couple of times on stage when I felt really free, and that's something else. I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear. So she said she'd felt it from time to time, but one of her greatest songs, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, makes it clear that that was always a destination, not something she'd realized.
So as we go out on that song, let me start. First, thank you, Craig Werner, for bringing Nina Simone to life, making us hear her music and think about her life in new ways. I really appreciate that.
Pleasure to share this great art.
I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air, and we'll go out with Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. This is my second-to-last broadcast for University of the Air after doing this for 30 years, and you'll be hearing more from Craig Werner, who was just talking about Nina Simone, in a moment. But I do want to take this opportunity to thank the many guests over the years, from Paul Carbone talking about cancer, to George Mossy on masculinity, to Stephen Ambrose on his book Undaunted Courage, or Chief Justice Shirley Abramson on what it meant to be in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, or our various senators, chancellors, and others who have been part of the story of Wisconsin. I have interviewed many guests, and one of them that keeps getting called back is Craig Werner, professor of African American Studies and Integrated Liberal Studies, who brings to life many different figures. I'd like to end with a few samples from other programs Craig Werner has done with me over the years, bringing to life various figures important to our history. Joining me to explore women of the civil rights movement is Craig Werner. So why should we know about women of the civil rights movement? What do we miss out if we only hear sort of the conventional narrative?
Simple answer is the truth.
The movement
was publicly headed by Dr. King and a variety of other leaders, almost all of them male. But the work that created real change in the conditions of life for African Americans in the United States came largely out of organizations, organizing energies in the community that were led by women from the very beginning.
Well, let's start with Rosa Parks, because she is this icon of the movement. There's, you know, a photo of her sitting on the bus, and I think most of us do have a sort of image of her as just one day having been fed up.
But she'd been an activist working on issues primarily of sexual violence for well over a decade before she made that decision not to surrender her seat on the bus in Montgomery.
Working as a volunteer?
She was both a volunteer and a paid activist. She'd worked and worked throughout her life for different organizations, but she came to prominence in 1944 over a case of sexual violence against a woman named Richie Taylor in Abbeville, Alabama. And Rosa Parks had been sent out as an investigator to see what had happened, to interview people, to dig up the truth of the case. And she had continued to be involved with that issue from the beginning. So one of the reasons that's important to focus on women in the movement is that although kind of the standard narrative of the movement says it was about legal rights, it was about passing laws, it was about getting unjust procedures, processes removed. From the perspective of the African-American community, one of the most important issues, I would say the most important issue, was stopping sexual violence against black women who worked as domestics, largely.
Well, I guess I have to ask, why then do we have the wrong idea of Rosa Parks? Was it deliberately presented that she was just a tired old seamstress, or how did that misconception come about?
Rosa Parks was a very useful symbol, and she understood her role as a symbol in the Montgomery bus boycott. She was not the first woman in Montgomery to have refused to give up her seat on the bus. There's a young woman, Claudette Colvin, who shortly before Rosa Parks sparked the movement, her famous action, had done something very, very similar. But Claudette Colvin was not a good symbol for the movement. She was dark-skinned, was part of it, and Rosa Parks was light-skinned, and that mattered at the time. She came from a lower-class background. She was a very good student, but she was pregnant at the time, and so the movement was well aware that they couldn't put her out front because she would be attacked. Rosa Parks was the last word and respectable. She looked good. She was articulate, and she accepted the role that she was given in the movement to serve as the face of the movement, really.
So she was kind of planted on the bus that
She day? Was not planted on the bus. It was a choice that she made on the spur of the moment, but not unthinkingly. She was well aware of the situation with segregation on the buses. She was well aware that the local activists were looking for a test case. And she simply decided that her moment had come. And she said,
"People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired, but that isn't true. I was not tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old, although some people have an image of me as being old then. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in.
And she knew she'd be arrested?
She knew she would be arrested. The bus driver whose bus she was on was notorious for his mistreatment of the African-American community. So, yes, she knew what was coming.
And what gave her the courage, in your opinion? I mean, you look at all these people who came out of the same circumstances, and there seem to be some people who have that, I don't know what it is, mm-hmm. that gives them the strength to get arrested, to get beaten, to get clobbered. And for Rosa Parks, where was that core coming from?
It went back to her childhood, that she grew up in a household where her grandfather told her stories and where she experienced the reality of white supremacist violence in the community around her all the time. And she simply was aware of that world. And then beyond that, I think it's almost mystery what it gives one individual mm-hmm. the right to do that. But from the very beginning, she knew that she was tired of what was happening around her. And she also took her strength from her knowledge that she wasn't alone. She knew that she was part of a community that represented many, many other people. That's another one of the important things about black women in the movement, is that they had done the hard work in the churches and just the things that women always do, you know, taking care of the day-by-day details. The men got the publicity, the women did the work, mm-hmm. and Rosa Parks came directly out of that tradition.
Soloist on that song, Wade in the Water, was Fannie Lou Hamer, singer and civil rights activist. Fannie Lou Hamer, we know her as a singer, but that side of her as an activist, I think, is less known.
Yeah, and it's really how she saw herself as an activist first, and she used the singing to support that. She's an amazing story. She was the youngest of 20 children who grew up on a plantation in Sunflower County, Mississippi, which for African Americans was about as close to the pit as you could get at that time. And she was not the kind of person you would expect to be a leader, but she was exactly the kind of person that Ella Baker was imagining, the kind of person who could galvanize a community. Her voice was a big part of that.
And how did she step into the story? We've talked about the bus boycotts, the sit-ins, the freedom rides. At what point does Fannie Lou Hamer sort of jump on board the civil rights story?
In 1962, she heard James Bevel, who was working with SNCC, the organization that Ella Baker had put together, give a sermon in Mississippi as part of organizing, trying to build the energies that ultimately led to Freedom Summer in 1964, dedicated to getting black people registered to vote in Mississippi. And Hamer thought that working with SNCC sounded a whole lot better than picking more cotton. And apparently she was a tremendous cotton picker, could pick hundreds of pounds of cotton in a day. But she signed on with SNCC, and in 1963, she went to a workshop in South Carolina, which was being conducted by Septima Clark, one of the people that Ella Baker trained at Highlander. The networks are all over the place here. And on the way back, she and the people she was with were stopped by the police in Winona, Mississippi. And they were imprisoned, and they were brutalized, and they were kept incommunicado for several days. It was one of the most vicious attacks on activists in a movement which was filled with vicious attacks on activists. And she was already committed to the movement, but that didn't scare her off. That reinforced her determination to make a difference.
And the details that she describes of the brutality are really appalling.
Yeah, she testified before the Democratic National Credentials Committee at the 1964 convention in Atlantic City, and she described her beating.
I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat me. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro who had beat to sit on my feet to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. All of this is on account of we want to register, to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave? Well, we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
Hearing that, it makes then, when you hear her voice singing, it's sort of just incredible, sort of the brutality that she overcame and then somehow was able to put into song as well.
And transforms it into determination. That wade in the water is a song goes way back to slavery with slaves trying to escape. And it was saying, wade in the water so the dogs can't follow you. You know, God's going to trouble that water. God's on your side in this ultimately. But obviously, you had to survive all kinds of brutality, some of it physical, but some of it institutional. Because the other thing that Fannie Lou Hamer did was commit herself to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
I think the common theme running through all the stories of women in the civil rights movement is that they were so outspoken and courageous and tireless, even though they didn't put their ego out there in the front of them.
I think that's a really good way to say it. It really was the power of love that they were working off of. The power of Jesus, all of them would have said it that way, one way or another, that it was deeply grounded in their Christian faith, and that that was a faith that bound them to other people, to their community, and it was not ultimately about them as individuals. It was about black people as an oppressed people struggling for freedom, and all of them understood it was also about white people. It was about America. Fannie Lou Hamer says, is this America? She's asking us to be what we claim we are. You know, it's a great gospel song. Mahalia Jackson sung it often. I'm going to live the life they sing about in my song. That's what the women of the civil rights movement were asking us to do.
My guest has been Craig Werner, along with reader Sagacious Levingston. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.